This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Report. I'm Jonathan.
And Roman is present, and it is bloody early on a Friday morning to record, but...
It is early.
It's an important podcast.
It is an important podcast, indeed, and an important guest because, well, South Africa is somewhat lawless in many ways, and we have a few people who really do try to keep us on the straight and narrow, so to speak.
Whom? Oh, in South Africa?
Yeah.
Who might that be? one of my guests. Well, not us personally.
Oh, no, you're definitely not anarchist. We'll get into your notions of justice.
I'm the most law-abiding anarchist in the world. It's quite strange.
Are anarchists normally not law-abiding? They just want to be left alone and to their own devices?
Anarchists tend to go in the streets and like blow things up. But that's the lefty anarchist.
Yes, I think that's the old view of what an anarchist is.
No, that's the left-wing anarchy.
So South Africa is an anarchy then. That's a left-wing anarchy, but an anarchy nevertheless.
Yeah, under the guise of service delivery protests.
Well, we've got service delivery protests. We've got people who will kind of commit crimes and feel that they don't need to answer for them. You know, kind of kill people in car accidents and things like that and walk away.
Yeah, it tends to happen. But not anymore.
Yes, which brings us to our guest. Right, well, as you may have heard, if you don't pay attention to our social media platforms, our guest today is none other than Advocate Gerry Nel. Gerry is well known to most South Africans, should be well known to you through years of being part of the National Prosecuting Authority and prosecuting many, many cases, including some very high-profile ones. Gerry, I think you became a bit famous for the Oscar Pistorius trial.
Reluctantly so. I mean, a prosecutor never wants to be famous. I never wanted to be.
Yeah.
And the one thing about the Pistorius matter, I was just there that, at first we opposed the fact that it should be on live TV. But when it happened, I was just stunned by the fact that people knew so little about what's going on in our courts. You know, before we started with that particular case, there were TV shows discussing if we still had the jury system going. I mean, that's true.
Yeah.
And
too much television, perhaps?
Too much exposure to American court systems and so on.
So do you think the fact that it was televised was actually a benefit?
Indeed.
Because it showed, A, that court work can be quite boring. I'm joking. And number two, that, well, it shows you what it means to be a prosecutor and a defense advocate.
Yeah, it's not boring, but there's a process, right?
Yes.
And it doesn't take place over sort of a 40-minute episode on television. There's workings.
Yeah, and I think the most important issue about the Pistorius matter was really this fact that law is not a court case. It's a process.
Mm.
If there's a court case and you're not satisfied, you think justice wasn't served, I mean, you can go and appeal, and it's a process. People criticize the process if it relates to the president by saying that the president's been dragging us out in courts for many, many years. But like anybody else in this country, you must be able to use all the processes.
Yeah, and any other person in his position would use the processes as well.
Indeed. If I was in his position, I would do exactly the same. I would go through the processes, but then I really do think that was the end now, as far as process is concerned.
Well, as far as the process is, yes. I mean, the SCA has said no. The decision to withdraw the charges were irrational. So as of now, there seems to be confusion. So as of now, he's back to where he was before Mokotedim Shed withdrew the charges. So he has the charges already.
Yeah, 100%. Judge Ludwaba gave the first judgment in the Gauteng High Court. And Judge Ludwaba went so far as to say that it's now time that the president face the charges in the indictment. So that's where he is at the moment. But because of the procedures and process, the NPA will have to enroll the matter again.
Right.
So they will have to draft an indictment and subpoena the president to court and start the matter fresh. But I'm sure that things will happen before then.
So, yes. Yeah.
Well, I mean...
So it's still a long way to go if the court process... I mean, it's near the end of the process, but there's still a way to go. There's still time to do a lot of different...
They shouldn't be. It shouldn't be a long way. I mean...
this is my frustration. What are we... Almost 10 years in the making of this particular case, and... We don't seem to be towards the end. You're telling us we're getting to the end, but is the end 2 years, 3 years? You know, the president has shown that he has great interest in dragging this out as long as he possibly can. So I'm just wondering if he wants to make it last as long as possible before he has to sit in a court. How long are we talking?
The one issue of criticism would be if they allow the president to make representations before they enroll in the matter. Because in normal court cases, the matter will be enrolled and you will have an opportunity to make representations.
Yeah, after the fact. Yeah.
So it's on the record then.
Yes. So that is that I'll criticize that. And I think if the accused in this particular matter was Nell, he would have been before court next week, you know, within 2 weeks of the SCA judgment. But then, you know, we're dealing with the president of the country and we're dealing with a matter that goes back about 9-10 years. So it's not that easy. It's difficult.
It is difficult. So I mean, Mr. Nell, after 36 years in the MPA, now you're in private. What do you call it? Private law? How would you describe
it? It's a new entity,
today?
Really.
Yeah, it's a new way of doing law.
Yeah, it's exciting. You know, it's unique in the world. There's no other office.
Is it a unique in the world?
There's no other office for private prosecutions anywhere. There's never been in South Africa.
Do you think that's a positive reflection of South Africa or a negative one? Because is it positive that we've got this process where there's freedom for public prosecution? Well, not public, private prosecution. Or is it a negative one in that it shows our system failing?
You know, I would think it more to be more positive that we allow people to privately prosecute if there's no prosecution. I just think it's absolutely brilliant that we allow that and that we've made provision for that in our law. It's a bit difficult, though, when we get to things like corruption, because corruption, it's very difficult to show that you've got a peculiar interest in prosecuting a corruption matter.
Because that's one of the foundations. So you, as the advocate, have to show that you have been personally, or your client has been personally affected by a decision of sorts.
Indeed. So we all know that people refer to corruption as a victimless crime.
Yeah.
So it will be very difficult to get a certificate to prosecute corruption. But I do think it's a perfect time to develop the law. You know, Judge Musaneke gave a judgment in the Glenister case. And he said the following, it's a long quotation, but at the end he said...
We've got time.
You know, then let me read it, because it's absolutely brilliant.
Go for it.
Judge Musaneke, you know, he's just my favorite judge between him and, I've forgotten the judge in the Constitutional Court.
O'Regan.
Cameron. Ah. Edwin Cameron. I mean, he said, corruption threatens to fall at the knees of virtually everything we hold dear and precious in our hard-won constitutional order. It blatantly undermines the democratic ethos, the institutions of democracy, the rule of law, and the foundational value of our nascent constitutional project. It fuels maladministration and public fraudulence and imperils the capacity of the state to fulfill its obligations to respect, protect, promote, and fulfill all the rights enshrined in the Bill of Rights. When corruption and organized crime flourish, sustainable development and economic growth are stunted, and in turn, the stability and security of society is put at risk. Isn't that absolutely brilliant?
Yeah,
if the stability
true.
In society is put at risk, then certainly society must have a right to protect themselves against this threat and be able to prosecute if the MPA doesn't want to.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, just on that, on the point of our judiciary, it's been very impressive as a body in the past, well, I suppose decades or so.
Well,
where,
since the inception of the Constitution.
Well, certainly, but I suppose they've come to the fore because we've got almost a failing government in many senses. The NPA has now had issues, but we've got this judiciary which seems to be, have a lot of integrity and character.
And it's so important because we're a constitutional
democracy.
And that is important. if the Constitution is the supreme law, then certainly the courts must play an unbelievably important role, and they have been. I mean, you know, just to think of all the judgments we've had, but recently the secret vote judgment by Judge Mkhweng Mkhweng, it's absolutely brilliant. Mm. You know, you can read and read that judgment. It's like poetry.
Yeah, I mean, what I like that the fact that they're fighting for their independence. They're a very independent body, but in spirit, I think they share a lot of ideology with the ANC, because they are a progressive body still. They're independent, but they still share ideology and political narrative.
Oh, that's very philosophical, but
sure.
Other people would say that with the majority of people. They share an ideology with the majority of people.
Sure.
But if you really look at the matters, and you know, I'm a prosecutor, finishing law. That's all I've ever been. And so my area of expertise is criminal law. Mm. And in terms of criminal law, I just think there's very little scope to criticize our courts. Eventually, if you get to the end of the whole process, you know, if you go to the SCA and from the SCA to the Constitutional Court, I'm confident about what our courts are doing in criminal law.
In criminal law specifically?
Yeah.
Yeah. So if I may ask, what is an ordinary, in the MPA, you were there for 36 years as a prosecutor. So what does a prosecutor do day to day? What does it look like? I've seen the inside of a lawyer's office defending a criminal matter, but I've never been inside a prosecutor's office.
Of course you have, Ramon.
Yeah, but it's so much easier. We're just honest.
You're dishonest or just honest?
We're just honest.
Oh, just
so
honest.
So much easier to be a prosecutor. You get allocated trials.
So you don't pick the ones that people from on top send them to you?
You know, but the more senior you get, the more leeway you have in picking your own cases. But in general, you get allocated cases. And you then start preparing your cases. But it's not only that. I mean, there's appeals and review opinions and so forth. But you keep yourself busy with court-directed duties the whole day.
Okay.
I've been a court animal forever.
So your job description is quite narrow.
Yeah, in terms of criminal law, it's narrow and it's all court-directed.
So when you say you were born a prosecutor, what does that mean? What characteristics do you have that makes you say that?
Okay. I absolutely hate unfairness. I mean, I started studying law because I absolutely hate unfairness and I hate bullies. Now, bullies in a wide sense, you know, somebody walks into your house armed to the teeth, pushes you around, shoots people, that's just a bully with a gun, you know. And if somebody commits corruption, steal public money, that's a bully. That's a bully with power. But also businessmen that would collude and fix prices, that's a gang of bullies. A gang of people getting together to fix prices. I mean, we all know that 12.9 billion was added to the bill for the building of the stadiums during the 2010 World Cup. 12.9 billion by price fixing. So those are all bullies, and that's why I decided to be a prosecutor and remain a prosecutor.
So that's your sense of justice, though, to fighting bullies in a much wider sense than just what
to fight bullies.
Oh, really? Yeah. Is that bread and butter?
That is about it. Because
very simple.
You know, it's unfairness and it's bullies.
I like that you're able to explain it in simple terms.
And justice as an overall term, because you know, if you go looking for a definition, in fact, recently we were having a discussion with some of our listeners, and it, you know, I kind of raised what I thought justice means, but. No one kind of has an absolute sense of what is justice. So fighting the bully and you know, getting the bully to not do what they do anymore and punishing them.
Okay, well, I'll explain it this way. For justice, there should be equality. Equality before the law. Without equality before the law, it's impossible to have justice without equality, because if we don't all believe that we treated equally in terms of the law, there'll never be justice. Now, I've got, you know, in terms of equality, I've got lots of documents along. So
no, that's fine.
I have
that's
to.
We're the usual unprepared, Ramon and I sitting here with nothing in front
something.
Of us.
But, you know, the first Chief Justice in the United States was a man called John Jay. And that was in 1745. And with his speech, when he accepted the position, he said, Justice is indiscriminately due to all without regard to numbers, wealth, or rank, which is absolutely brilliant. And this particular principle goes so far back as 431 before Christ, where funeral, with the funeral of Pericles, a brilliant king, they first wrote documents about the democracy in Athena and also about the law. And remember, it's 431 before Christ. They wrote the following. If we look to the laws, they afford equal justice to all in their private differences, class consideration not being allowed to interfere with merit, nor again does poverty bar the way. For me, that's equality before the law. And
So it's sort of stripping away social influences and leave you as an individual, and the responsibility of your behavior is with you.
And if I believe that, there's justice.
People in 431 BC were classical liberals.
They were woke, man.
Yeah, so let's talk quickly about this matter that's sort of thrust you back into the news. We don't want to get into too much of the details because I'm sure it will be part of the headlines for the months to come and all the nitty-gritty. But what made you decide to go after the Duduzani Zuma case specifically? And just give us a quick background on that.
You know, what happened, this matter happened in February 2014. Mm. And then the NPA on two occasions decided not to prosecute. Now, one was in June 2014. They referred it to the Randburg Magistrates Court for a formal inquest. People testified. Mr. Zuma testified, was cross-examined. Other people testified.
And he was allegedly driving his vehicle and hit another vehicle. And someone was killed in that process.
Yeah. And referred the formal inquest record back to the NPA, decided not to prosecute again. But you know, what was really when I was surprised when I had discussions with the family, they were never consulted and they were never informed of this fact. I mean, it's a family that, I mean, they don't know the law. Mm. They were just waiting for things to happen and nothing happened.
If I may interrupt quickly, is it a requirement for the family to know the reasons why there will be no prosecution or there will be a prosecution?
I wouldn't say the reasons. You can ask the reasons, but you should know that. I think you should inform the family that there won't be any further prosecution.
I mean, there is sort of a duty of the NPA. Maybe not a legal duty, but a moral duty, indeed, one would think.
Especially if you've gone through a formal inquest for days.
Sure.
And that was in the public eye, in the public domain, and then nothing happened. And that was the one issue. So, but strangely enough, it came out in the Gupta email leaks that there was a decision to not prosecute in August 2015. And when I read that, I made contact with the counsel that appeared for the family. I then made contact with the family. And the first time I met them, I mean, it came out that they were never consulted. Also, that they received no support whatsoever, no emotional or financial support. There was a little girl, she was 2 years at the time, the deceased little girl. She's now 5. She lives in Zimbabwe. They don't have enough money to send her to creche. And you know, and those kind of things. And I just thought, you know, if Mr. Zuma was perhaps Nell, he would have been prosecuted.
In terms of the after effects that you're describing, you would like to take this up as a criminal matter?
Yes.
Assuming it all goes through and it becomes a court case, and ultimately the accused would be found, if assuming they're found guilty, that would lead to some sort of prison sentence or at least some sort of sanction. What about something that looks more to pay the damages, of that child who can't go to creche, for example?
We're busy with that. They immediately filed a claim with the Road Accident Fund. That was in 2014. Nothing happened up until now. So we also said that we'll take that on. There's a lawyer appointed, but we'll now make contact with the lawyer and we'll follow up on that.
Help where you can. Yeah.
But you can have two claims against Mr. Zuma.
Indeed.
A criminal claim and a civil claim.
Without a doubt.
And we were discussing this before the show. I don't want to lose the point, but Ramon was kind of saying, you step in if I'm strawmanning you, but Ramon was kind of saying, well, surely if someone does something wrong, then we can come together as parties and agree I did something wrong. What have I done to hurt you, and how have I affected you? And then I can kind of like pay you off in some respect.
No, I said come to a settlement that is amenable to both parties.
Settlement.
If it includes a payment, yes. If it includes something else, whatever the case might be. As long as there's consent on both sides, I think that's justice to me.
You see, and I obviously we were in an argument about that. So for me, one should really look at sentence. Sentence is not an easy subject of the law. But in terms of the retributive and deterrent aspects of sentence, if we can all just get together and sort this out, I mean, how would we ever enforce the law? How would we ensure that, that society is protected against criminals?
Well, but with respect, Mr. Nell, even with that happening now, criminals still exist. Criminals still, you know, still commit crime.
Let me just tell you, you know, I've been a prosecutor for lots of years, and I've said all along that I think it must be the most rewarding career because I've done big cases. Mm. And to sit with the victim's family and the victims afterwards and to have a discussion where they tell you that we now, thank you very much, justice was done. We can now move on. That money can't buy.
Sure.
And so how would you do that? How would you, when somebody feels that justice means that the person should be punished and also deterrent. You know, we talk about things, but the deterrent value of sentence and of the law is really important. It keeps us in check because if you know that if you go to the golf club and have one too many to drink and you drive out there, if you know it, that you'll be arrested. You'll never do it.
Oh, sure.
But now we think we won't be arrested.
But it's true. We probably won't be there. That's the problem.
But so for me, we talk about lots of things about sentence where we should talk about the predictability of the law.
I think you're probably correct. I mean, I certainly don't do many things. I'm not really bad things. I don't fantasize about those. But you know, I drink and drive would certainly be one that I wouldn't do because I would just be like, well, it's not worth it. Because yes, Ramon, I probably won't get caught. But if I do, it's potentially life changing in a very destructive manner. So I hear the that side of thing. I think it's interesting that you mention about that closure that families get. Because it brings back to, you know, equal in front of the law. Because, you know, you can buy, if you have enough money, you can probably buy your way out of most things. You know, the culpable homicide for crashing your car into someone.
If the victim's family agrees to it, I don't see a problem with it.
Yeah, I think maybe that's a sense of what society views as justice.
Exactly.
In terms of that settling it just with money. Money becomes nothing really, to a lot of people. I'm not saying they're right or wrong. I'm saying that's a perception that seems to exist.
And Ramon, that is what I started with, equality before the law, to ensure justice.
Mm.
Now, if you can sit with somebody and as you just said, if you have enough money to pay off or you have the resources or there's a way of doing it and I don't, then there's no equality. There could be justice in the sense of the people involved in a specific incident.
Yes.
But not justice as should be viewed by society. Because
I mean, if there is a coherent view of what justice is in a society, I don't know if we are there yet.
But just also, you know, there's civil law. Civil law is exactly what you're saying.
Yes. No, true.
I mean, you claim from someone and you settle it. So that's civil law. But criminal law is a bit different. Criminal law is society's way of ensuring that we're all law-abiding citizens. And if you don't, you have to pay for it. But if somebody defrauds you out of something, you can follow civil law, and that's exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's what struck me about when I watched you during the Oscar Pistorius case. You stepped in the shoes of Reva Steenkamp, or at least her family.
Yeah.
And you were just as angry as I expected them to be, were they standing where you are. How do you get to a position where that happens?
Mm.
Where you don't take it personally as Gerinel, but you say, I'm representing the interest of society in general and the family in particular. So how do you get to that?
It goes back to what I said. I see crime as a bully. Every criminal is a bully in some way or other.
And you do take it personally then in some respects?
You know, no, not in a particular
matter. I'm not saying you act out in a personal fashion. I'm just saying you can, because it's a good question from Ramon. You know, it's almost as if you feel it quite deeply. And instead of you just going through the motions, you're very sincere in your presentation.
I have a sense that I must ensure that justice is done.
Yeah, I'm not saying you seek revenge or retribution, but if you believe that society needs justice, it would be within Gerinal at that time in court.
Yeah,
you'll be representing all of us.
Yeah, if that makes sense. I'll do what it takes to ensure that justice is done, and so would Barreiro do what it takes to look after his client's interest. And that particular matter, I just, you know, it's so much easier to go up against somebody like Barry because he's absolutely brilliant. So you could just go out and do what you have to do. You don't have to care about the accused. You don't have to care to be seen to be unfair or something like that. You don't have any other obligation but to do what you have to do because you know that Barry would look after his client's interest.
Right. I mean, especially when Mr. Pistorius came out and you said, do you know what a zombie stopper is? He says, no, I have no idea. Oh, look at this video. And you show him like shooting a watermelon with his high caliber pistol. That was very effective.
Yeah. All right. So this private prosecution concept, look, it seems like a great idea. The government can decide whether or not they want to prosecute. Am I correct in saying that if they decide Jonathan today drove into a pedestrian, the pedestrian was killed or injured, we've decided not to prosecute because Jonathan's a good friend of ours, you can then go, I want to prosecute Jonathan, and they have to give you the appropriate permission?
If I'm able to show a peculiar interest in their decision not to prosecute.
Okay.
So
and who decides that if there's a fight?
Well, the courts will eventually decide that.
Sure.
And there was a matter, the real, you know, Kari Krill of Reforum contacted me in April 2015 to join AfriForum and to create this office. I knew it was necessary to create an office, but I didn't think it was possible. And then there was a judgment in the National NSPCA case. And that's what I want to tell you. What happened there is they applied for a nolle prosequi certificate. The NPA said no. They went to Bloemfontein, the SCA. The SCA said no, and they then approached the Constitutional Court because everybody said that they did not have a right. The SPCA, but they couldn't show a peculiar interest. In that particular matter, they were able to use Section 8 of the Criminal Procedure Act, which gives them a right to prosecute. You know, like you can also prosecute NEMA, is the Energy Management Act, National Energy Management Act. It would give certain organizations the power to prosecute if the NPA should refuse. But so to answer your question, if I'm able to prove a peculiar interest, then certainly they have one of two choices, either prosecute themselves or give a certificate. But there's one very important aspect, and that is when you prosecute someone, before you initiate prosecution, you have to guarantee his cost. So if we fail to successfully prosecute, we have to pay all the costs.
Oh, is that the mechanism to stop frivolous private prosecution,
indeed,
so to speak?
It. But the flip side of that coin is if we successfully prosecute, they have to pay our costs.
Okay.
And that's why the NPA is obliged to take over. If you start with a private prosecution and you're doing well, they're obliged to take over or to offer to take over to save cost.
Really?
Yeah, that's the law.
So you could initiate the process. Indeed. Say you get the certificate from the NPA and you initiate the process, and then the second week of trial, the NPA says, oh, by the way, Mr. Nell, we want to come back in. Is that your decision?
It's my decision, knowing that the cost will only... There will only be costs up until that stage where they offer to take over. You know, thereafter, I just carry my own cost. It happened the latest, one of the only successful prior prosecutions is a woman who was killed in Cape Town. She came from Durban. Her boyfriend lured her to Cape Town. She was killed.
Yes, I remember this.
And at sentence stage, the NPA said, now we want to get involved. The family said, no, you know, go somewhere else. We'll take this through. So if you know all those things, I mean, those three things, that they have the first bite at the cherry, the NPA. When you apply, they have a second bite at the cherry. and thirdly, they're obliged to take over from you, it just becomes so clear that if we then successfully prosecute, who had some kind of motive, us or the people that took the decision?
Yeah, I mean, the cards are already stacked against you as indeed, a private prosecutor.
But it should be. As you said, there shouldn't be frivolous prosecutions. It would be horrible if anybody can take you to court at any time and you have to...
It would also clog the courts quite a lot.
And then you have to pay Barry Roos fees, which is exorbitant. but, you know...
Do you at least beat him at golf?
Yeah, I'm a much better golfer than him.
All right, so... That's great. So as long as you get kind of the certificate, you can then prosecute. As you say, the only office like this in the world is doing this. So should we get to the point where we basically just have a whole bunch of offices for private prosecution? You know, the MPA is a government entity. Government tends to do things quite inefficiently. Why not just go full private? I mean, we're big fans of full private on this show. You know, we like private schooling, private healthcare,
private justice system.
There you go. So why not? And it is interesting because libertarian view would be, for example, that you know, government would exist for three things: protect the borders, provide policing inside, and provide justice or courts.
Yeah, you see, yeah, I'm of a different view. I just think that the MPA is the government's way of ensuring that there's criminal justice. So, and government must be, if it's elected government, democratically elected government, must be an institution that would send out policies of prosecution and will make new laws, and so they must be able to enforce them. Lots of things have happened in South Africa. You know, we would not have had this discussion if we had, and I'm going to say that because I worked with Mr. Pikoli. I mean, Mr. Pikoli would prosecute without fear, favor, or prejudice at any day.
Mm.
He lost his job.
For doing so.
For doing so. He prosecuted Mr. Selebe, which was a friend of his. I mean, it was a horrible time for him to go through, but he did it. So, and if we get somebody like Mr. Pikoli back, I'll be without a job.
Yeah.
And that is how it should be. I should be without a job. I should not have cases to look at, because I can only look at those matters where they decided not to prosecute, but there's still merit in the prosecution.
Yes.
Most cases, 95% of cases that they decide not to prosecute.
Yeah.
It's based on merit.
And I'm sure you were involved in many of those over the years, yes, deciding not to prosecute a
based
case.
Based on merit. It's just those 5% of cases where...
It's a bit grey.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you see, when we launched the office, I said, even if we address a perception of selective prosecution, we're doing a service, because there shouldn't even be a perception that there is selective prosecution.
That's interesting.
Yeah, but I mean, aren't you creating a perception by going after the president's son?
Well, I'm back of
selective private prosecution, so to speak.
Is it? I'm back at where I started in this. There must be merit.
Yes.
So.
I think there is. Well, I'm not a prosecutor by any means, but it seems like a clear cut case.
I'm not a parallel prosecution stream. I can't go out there and pick a case and do it.
Right.
They must have the first bite at the cherry. They must have a second bite at the cherry, and then we prosecute. So what's the proof of putting us in the eating? If we successfully prosecute, who made the first mistake?
I mean, that'll be historical.
Yeah.
That'll be really historical. A private prosecution ending up – and sorry, if you – a private prosecution, the sentencing is obviously done by the court anyway. So use the complete – all you're doing is you're just replacing the NPA in the court. But the sentencing, everything else is done by the judge.
Law of evidence, law of procedure, same judge, same magistrate, exactly the same, yeah.
Okay.
Right. So, I mean, it's interesting that basically that proposition is that you're actually strengthening the justice system by showing, you know, by if it has a lapse. You're going, all right, guys, I've seen you've maybe missed a trick here. I'm going to take a look at it. And if you want to come in at any point, you're welcome to offer. But we're going to take a look at it. And in so doing, the few small percent or few small cases that they do miss ultimately are followed up on.
Indeed. So people should – well, the MPA should say, that's fine. Nell's got a role to play. and we look at what his views when he get matters, and we'll reconsider. Really, if they reconsider any of the cases that we apply for a not a prosecutor certificate, and they do it themselves, we have done what we set out to do.
Certainly.
So, no, if I may ask, the difference between working for the NPA and working by yourself now, how is that? Because 36 years in one job is a hell of a long time. You're still doing the same job, but in
probably
completely different
institutionalized.
You know, I would have never made the move to, like you said, Ramon, to go out and defend people. I'm just a prosecutor. And the reason why I decided to do it is because I'm still just a prosecutor. So I can still prosecute matters. It's very different. It was the right time for me because I'm an old man. You know, I was sitting there contemplating retirement and so forth when AfriForum approached me. So it's a good time just to do something new. It's exciting. The one thing about private prosecution is that the NPA, they just have so much more resources. And rights in terms of acts to do things, to gather evidence and those kind of things. But on the other hand, we can only go and prosecute matters based on what they had at the time. And if they decided not to prosecute, so all we need is the evidence, the case docket that was presented to them to do our case on. If we do more, then they can certainly turn around and say, now that you've done more investigation, we're willing to prosecute. Then it's fine.
You know. Really? So they take credit for the work you do as
you know,
well?
For me, really, it's about
it's equality
about justice,
for
the law, and it's about no selective prosecution. You know, selective prosecution, some people you prosecute and some not. But it's even worse when you prosecute somebody with no facts or with not a good case. I mean, that is even worse than it happened.
Yeah, that does happen.
Yeah. So those things, if we can just deal with it in some way, I don't think, so if we have some success, I'll be happy.
But if I may ask, the last decade within the NPA, there were issues, though, between yourself and the people higher up. I can't remember, Mrs. Jiba and Lawrence Murebi. Like, there were issues they arrested you for for a few days. They bugged your office and your house, I believe. If I remember, this was over a decade ago.
Not the nicest work environment.
I mean, at the end of the day, during your final few years there, did you feel like a pariah for doing your job?
No. You see, we're still at the Scorpions. I think we dealt with more politically sensitive matters. In when we did the Celebi matter, you know, we were a small team up against South African Police Service, up against lots of people, up against lots of people in government. But I still see my team, the team we had at the time. What happens when we got that conviction, you know, just that moment of thinking that it's been a hard journey, but we've succeeded, that makes up for lots of things. So whatever happened in the NPA, that moment that you have at the end of a case makes up for a lot. My last couple of years in the NPA, I did just normal cases. I did the Henning matter, a woman that was killed when she dropped a child off.
Her husband.
I became involved in the Pistorius matter and did other matters. And I kept myself out of mainstream decision-making in the NPA. I just became a prosecutor again.
But how would you, if you were still there now, how would you feel a lot more despondent than at the time that you left? Because it seems to be a hollow shell, the NPA now.
Yeah, it's very difficult. What I can say is, if I think back to the NPA and my years there, it's definitely 10 years or more back that I'm
playing. Right.
So, and we think back at those times and so on. And I enjoyed it. You know, I was a born prosecutor, I prosecuted in the Darby Lewis Valus case.
Back then?
Yeah.
Okay, the Chris Hani assassination.
Yes, and so I've been around forever, and I've enjoyed it. I really have. You know, if I look back at my career in the MPA, and because it happens to all our old people, you just think of the good times.
Yeah.
And the good successes and so on. Mm. So I'm happy. Sitting where I am, I'm happy.
Tell me a little bit about the teams that you work with, because I think what we see, and you know, you've mentioned the positives of filming the Oscar Pistorius case. I suppose one of the negatives is that it's sort of, we all knew you, we exactly. all knew Barry Roux, we all knew M'Lady, you know, the door became part of our lives, and everyone became almost a prop. But there's a lot we don't see behind the scenes, investigators and researchers, and what goes into, you know, a case, even a normal, just a relatively straightforward case, so to speak.
A prosecutor is nothing without a team. You know, I cannot do all that. Let me just give you examples. We're busy with the celebrity matter, and it's a Sunday night, and I'm busy cross-examining the accused. And the man, Chris Gouws, phoned me late on a Sunday. He said, "You think he got something? Can he come across?" So Chris came across. And one of the biggest things we had in this celebrity matter was the money laundering with his overseas flights. We would declare when he leaves, he would declare 20,000, but when he comes back, he would cash in 60,000 or 40,000 rands. So it was a way of laundering money.
Right.
So, you know, it took Chris a whole night to explain to me what it's all about.
Yeah, how it works.
How it works. So, and the same with, you know, if you cross-examine any expert, there's an expert behind the scenes that helps you to understand what the person said. So it's lots of experience to be able to take what you can from the teams. But I had brilliant teams. Brilliant teams in the celebrity matter, absolutely brilliant. You know, what was important there is for a team that didn't get scared. The prosecutor got arrested, spent time in prison, but the team stuck with us. You know, the team stuck with me. When I got out, they were still working, and we carried on working. So you need a team for different cases. Mm. In the Pistorius matter, I had a brilliant team of experts, of investigators. So for every case, the prosecutor is as good as his team. The defense counsel is as good as the evidence of his client.
And how much money there is.
Indeed. Excellent.
So, sure, my train has just gone off that way. I wanted to ask, the celebrity matter gets I suppose, forgotten in some respects. Amongst the Pistorius case, but in many ways, the Celebi case was much bigger for the country. You know, here was a police commissioner who had extensive power. He was head of Interpol, I think, at the time. So, you know, not only the head of our policing service, but pretty much the international policing service. It really does get quite lost in all of it. What I want to get to is what do you think of this is your personal opinion on parole and the way parole is kind of seemingly, from my perspective as a citizen, unfairly doled out.
Let's talk about selective parole.
Okay, I'll deal with parole, but can I just say something about celebrity matter?
Yeah, go for it.
It was without a doubt the most difficult matter I ever prosecuted. Not only in terms of the circumstances of the case, but also in terms of the law. We did really well in terms of the law, and it's more so because Judge Joffe understood corruption, so did the SCA. But I want to read a quote from this particular case, so that whoever listens to this, if you just remember this quote and you read any front page of the newspapers again, you understand what corruption is, because we tend to overcomplicate corruption. Mm. We think it's so difficult. As soon as you get to corruption, you think it should be KPMGs and PwCs that should investigate. It's not really that. It's as easy as the following. The court said, "The appellant must have realized that Agliotti's generosity and the payments he received from him created a dynamic whereby he, in his post as head of the nation's police, would be indebted to him and would have to remain willing to do him favors." That's it.
Yeah, simple as that.
That's it. And it's not, there's no amounts, reciprocity, you know, yeah. What's the word?
Reciprocity.
Yeah,
I think.
Reciprocal actions. That's a word. That's very good word for Afrikaans speaker. That's
well done.
So you don't, as if you receive something with a corrupt intent, or you hand something over with a corrupt intent. If I know, and just think back about 3 weeks in the front page of the Sunday Times or City Press, if I know you're paying me to fix something up at the SOE, I just know that's why you're paying me. In terms of the law, you're guilty of corruption. You know, so corruption is as, and that's my view of it, it's as easy as your intention in receiving or accepting a gift or a benefit.
Well, I think some cabinet ministers might be guilty just in accepting their posts.
Ooh, a good point, actually. Good point.
Okay, so parole, as far as parole is concerned, over all the years, I really made a point of not dealing with the matter after sentence. And it's not the role of a prosecutor to do, or the NPA. The NPA should not be part of it except in advisory
capacity.
With regards to the case.
Yeah. But it correctional services, that's their speciality. They should deal with it. If there's problems there, they should deal with it. Prosecutors should never be blamed or even asked to deal with
But with respect, I think it's still a shit feeling if you do prosecute someone that could be dangerous, to endanger your life, endanger a few other people that you know, and then you prosecute someone, you're happy, and then 5 years later he's like out. Like, Selebi was ill, unlike someone else.
Absolutely.
Else we know. But I mean, all that hard work, and you're like, was justice really served?
You see, from my point of view, yes, I think that the moment that there's a sentence, the moment that there's a judgment, on that moment there's justice. And that is the role I can play. They have lots of other specialists in correctional services. You know, we should be very careful not to extend what we think our role should be, because just look at bail at the moment. You know, there are people saying that if there's lots of people threatening society, that if somebody gets bail, you should oppose bail, or bail should not be granted. And there's a set of rules that you should follow to grant bail or not, because the flip side is also true. If I want somebody to get bail, I can do exactly the same. Yeah. I could go out and burn places and do lots of things and say, if you don't give that person bail, more will follow. So, and the same with parole. Yeah. There should be people dealing with it. There should be a set of principles. For me, it's more important that if there's a set of principles, that it's applied equally to everyone. Now, if there's a set
it should go without saying. I mean, that's the point of the law, equal application. Yeah.
So for me, if you ask me about that, if there's an instance where there's not equal application of the principles of parole, certainly it's unfair.
But do you feel frustrated nowadays with how the NPA is not acting, with how just blatant everything is, just how blatant justice is not being served? How do you get affected personally, if you do? Or you just say, I'm focusing on my one case and everything else.
Not really.
Look, you're a citizen of the country.
You know, I've been giving talks in quite a few places, and I remember the one instance in Freyheit, Natal. Afterwards, a more mature lady said, you know, she's not so fed up with all the corruption and the front page of the newspaper. She doesn't follow the news. She doesn't want to read the news because it's just too much for her. I'm quite the opposite. Every time I read about something, I know it's out in the open. Somebody can deal with it. And if we don't know about it, we can't deal with it. So whatever, so it's my answer. As long as we're able to identify it and deal with it, we should. And then secondly, then society should play the role. We have the media playing their role. We have the media playing their role in the Gupta emails. We have the media playing their roles in exposing lots of things, and that's brilliant.
Mm.
But now society should step up and do it. You know, it might be rude or crude, whatever you want to say, but if somebody complains and they're doing nothing, I say they're wasting my time, really. They should be willing to also do something. Sure. And then we can all deal with it. So to answer your question, that's where society should play a role.
But I think they are, though. I mean, civil society is very, very strong now. Outers in court every second week. Who else? Helen Suzman Foundation.
They're doing brilliantly.
I mean, they do brilliantly, and they get funded by a lot of public donations, indeed, it seems.
So I say that if you're willing to fund them and if you're willing to support them, then you have reason to complain, and we listen to your complaints.
Yeah, but it just seems, I mean, personally, it just seems futile after a while if you just... Because Helen Suzman goes after just, you know, judicial appointments made by the president or by the executive. It takes 5 years or 6 years for the court to say, yes, the person appointed was not qualified to be appointed. But it's a very simple thing for the executive to do, but it's a very difficult thing for us to undo.
Yeah,
in terms of cost and time and things like that. That's the problem.
That's an argument, but without civil society... Where would we have been?
No, true.
So you can do a little, but I mean,
there's an imbalance of power in that regard. It takes money, effort, and time to undo a decision that can be made in 1 second by the president.
Yeah. But if it's not done, then that's the only role we can play.
Makes me think, interesting point about the democratization of our justice system or not, actually. Because... You know, you mentioned we are a constitutional democracy, but as far as our court system and our judiciary is concerned, we're not a democracy, really. And you know, I know this happens now, you know, in the United States, you can vote for your district judge, which has its own problems because, you know, 50, 60 years ago, when not every single human on earth was political, then your district judge would be a guy you thought was the best for the job or a woman you thought was best for the job. Now everything's politicized. So voting, getting the general populace to vote for a judge might not be a great idea. So we don't have that system. We have the system where we vote for the executive, and the executive then appoints the judges.
Well, no, the judges have their own special way.
Well,
he JSC, can. The JSC does.
JSC, but still the parliamentarians and other people
sign off.
They have a say, yeah.
So. Yeah, I think, do you still think that is the best system, given, assuming a completely corrupt executive, is it still working system?
Yeah, you know, I really do, because in terms of the JSC, your peers get an opportunity to nominate you to challenge your judgments and what you've done over years. The proof of the eating, the proof of putting is in the eating. Because, you know, when Judge Mogoeng was appointed, everybody said, okay, that's the end. He was appointed by the president. That's the end. We should have been Judge Moseneke. I was one of them.
Yeah, so were we. We were wrong.
So we were wrong. It's brilliant. Judge Mogoeng came. It turned out to be unbelievable.
Chief Justice,
no, unbelievable. No,
very strong and independent. Yeah.
Indeed. So I get this question a lot. Let's criticize the process if it fails us. At the moment, it's not. At the moment, I think.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, the process, it seems like it failed us because it takes so long.
Well,
maybe that's the problem.
You know.
But I mean, we can't control
that. It's that wheels of justice thing turn slowly. Yeah.
I'm an old man. Let me quote something again.
No problem
I'm
at all.
I'll quote in a minute, but let me just quote Churchill.
Oh, well, you're welcome to just read Churchill for the rest of the podcast, as far as I'm
Churchill
concerned.
He said that on the 23rd of July, 1929, justice moves slowly upon its path, but it reaches its goal eventually. And that's important. It should reach its goal eventually.
I can just picture your office with all these framed quotes. All over. Do you have framed quotes of Churchill and opposite dictums of judgments? Do you have those all over your office in frames?
No. I've got them all here, up here.
Understated. So we've got a few more minutes. Let's just talk about you a little bit. You know, you said you were going to leave the NPA, potentially retire, you know, then this other opportunity came up. And it is groundbreaking what you're doing, really, because this hasn't happened anywhere else before. But what are you doing besides golfing in your spare time, and how are you enjoying your life?
Well,
no longer a civil servant.
If you ask my family, they'll tell you I just golf every free moment I have. But I've got another passion, and that I've been a wrestler forever, and I'm a wrestling coach. I'm a wrestling coach at Menlo Park Wrestling Club.
sorry, like Greco-Roman wrestling?
Greco-Roman WWE, and freestyle, you know, Olympic wrestling.
Okay.
And I've been a coach of 4, 5, 6-year-olds for almost 20 years now. And I do it every week. Every Tuesday and Thursday, I go to a club and I coach these youngsters. And I walk in, you know, and I'm stressed and I think about what happened. And then I turn into Coach Gerry. And the next few hours is just brilliant.
Is Coach Gerry popular or is he very strict?
No, I'm strict. I enjoy these youngsters. You know, they do brilliant things and they're so eager to please. So for me, that's in the week, that's what I do. I escape to the wrestling club. And I'm a coach there, and then weekends I play golf.
Well, you know, Ramon won't join you on a round, but
I used to play golf when I was young. It's as Church. I'll give you another Winston Churchill quote. It's the best way to spoil a good walk.
Yeah, good walk spoiled. Yeah.
Wonderful, Ramon.
Yeah, abolish sports. Basically, is what I'm trying to say.
Is that how we end up? A great podcast on the law and justice.
So I just want to know. Is it Mr. Null Advocate Null?
No, it's Harry.
It's Harry.
Listen, I've got another quote about about sport and so on.
Oh, yeah, please.
You get LaBelle. Gert LaBelle is a chairperson of Transparency International. There was this conference, and the theme of the conference is integrity antidote for corruption. So, obviously it is, but there were brilliant papers delivered. Let me just quote from her. She said, integrity is not something that can be administered. It's something that must come from within. It must be inherent, and if it's not inherent, it must be learned. But then she went further and she said, children learn everything by example. That is why youth role models in the home and in school is so important. But it seems that in our society today, the kind of role models that stand for integrity are lacking. Our sport heroes routinely come up wanting. Our politicians rarely project the kind of image children can look up to. We clearly lack an abundance of Nelson Mandelas on the world stage. So sport and law and all those kinds of disciplines just show integrity. And if you can just teach people integrity through sport, through anything.
Yeah. I mean, I agree, but I'm not – I'm a cynic. Mm. I'm the most cynical person you'll probably ever meet in your life.
I think we all are.
I like people. I dislike people in authority. Because yeah. I think authority – changes the way people behave,
but it shouldn't. And the one aspect that would ensure that it's not is integrity, inherent integrity. Because if you're a good person,
sure,
you know, doing what you're doing,
and you stay that way no matter what position you
indeed.
Hold.
But people don't, though, and it's scientifically proven. I mean, we're having a psychologist on in a few weeks to tell us why that is the case. How what power does to your
brain.
Psyche? Yeah,
no, it's true.
But yeah, unfortunately. But nevertheless, I mean, Mr. Null, I think personally, South Africa is much better having an option like you. Not you specifically, but the business that you hold as a private prosecutor. I think every aspect of government should have a backup that people can go to. And I think it's a very positive move. And I wish you all the best.
Thank you.
Yeah, and good luck. Good luck with this first case. I assume there will be others.
Yes, there will be others. There definitely will be others.
Certainly. All right. Well,
do you want to give us a little tidbit? Just for our listeners.
It's just our listeners.
It will be matters that the NPA decided not to prosecute.
There you go. That is some very deep insights.
Breaking news.
Right. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate your time and for coming from Pretoria, because we're, you know, in the scummy Joburg over here. So. Apologies, but thank you so much. Thanks for joining us, and to all of you, thank you for listening. You can find us as always on Facebook, Renegade Report page and Renegade Report group, Twitter at Renegade_report. Gerry, are you on Twitter? Because there's someone pretending to be you on Twitter.
Yeah, and I enjoy reading about him, but I'm not there.
Is someone pretending to be,
not me.
Pretending to be you and someone pretending to be Barry, but yeah. not real Gerry.
Or real Barry.
Not
definitely
real Gerry.
Not real
Barry. Ramon is at Roman Kabanak. I'm at Jonathan_Witt. If you like the podcast, you can donate on Patreon. Thank you again for listening. We'll catch you next time. Cheers.
This is CliffCentral.com.